Welcome to MetaStrategy's Forum on World-Class IT. I'm Peter High, and I'm pleased to welcome Scott Phoenix to the broadcast. Scott is a co-founder at Vicarious, a high-profile artificial intelligence company focused on solving artificial general intelligence. Scott founded Vicarious with Dilip George in 2010. Prior to Vicarious, Scott was the entrepreneur-in-residence at Founders Fund, the co-founder and CEO of the touchscreen analytics company Frogmetrics, a Y Combinator company, and he also served as an executive at Only Secure and Marching Order. His design work has been featured in 16 magazines and 3 museums, including the Institute of Contemporary Art in Philadelphia. Scott earned his BAS in Computer Science and Entrepreneurship from the University of Pennsylvania. I recently caught up with Scott by phone in his office in Silicon Valley, and our conversation covered World-Class IT Principle 1, people, as we discussed how the company's bold mission acts as a magnet for world-class talent. Principle 2, infrastructure, as we discussed the technical details of what Vicarious is working on. We also covered how Vicarious is applying next-generation cognitive science to build general intelligence algorithms, how this differs from today's narrow applications of AI, how AI may impact jobs and society more generally speaking, why Vicarious prioritizes social good over investor returns, the promise and peril of AI, and a variety of other topics. This is Peter High. Please consider reading my new book, Implementing World-Class IT Strategy, How IT Can Drive Organizational Innovation. The book covers topics such as the CIO as strategic facilitator, the development of IT missions, facilitating corporate and divisional strategy, the development of IT's own strategic plans, the development of enterprise architecture, reviewing, refreshing, and communicating strategy, and several other topics, all told with stories from leading CIOs from a variety of major corporations. You can find it at Amazon.com, my publisher's website, Wiley.com, and at your better bookstores. Thank you very much. Scott Phoenix, welcome to the Forum on World-Class IT.
Thanks, Peter.
You are the co-founder of Vicarious, a company that is within the artificial intelligence realm. I thought we'd begin with a definition of AI. It is a term, as we've spoken about recently, that is thrown around in a variety of ways, and perhaps at this point, the definition of the term isn't as well known as it should be, and I wonder if we could take a moment to have you kind of unbundle it a little bit.
Artificial intelligence is a really funny thing for a couple of reasons. One is the moving goalposts phenomenon, which is that as soon as something that was formerly called artificial intelligence is solved, it's sort of like no longer included anymore in the umbra of what is AI. And then the other thing that I think is kind of funny about it is because it's such a funny term, you can apply it, and people do apply it to almost any business or products term or company that is developing anything. You could have a consumer gadget that has AI for making sure your windows are clean or AI in your spam filter. At Vicarious, we have a very particular and specific definition of what we mean when we say AI, which is artificial general intelligence, so human-like intelligence. And to put an even more specific frame around it, we say, given the same sensory experiences that a human being has from birth to adulthood, we're trying to write a program that learns the same concepts and has the same abilities. It's a very specific thing. Whereas artificial narrow intelligence, or AI as it's used commonly today, could mean just a computer that does some stuff that's useful.
As we have machines that are able to do a lot of the processing that humans today, or in some cases recently at least, are doing, is there any worry that there are aspects of the way that we think, certainly aspects of the way that we work, that are going to change profoundly? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, let's take a bigger historical lens on this. And the people listening to this podcast, first of all, you're listening to a podcast right now. Put that in context of what people were doing in the 1800s through 1700s. And it's just a totally different world that we live in now. So yes, I think the types of work that will be done by people in the future are going to be different than the types of work that are done today. And that has always been true. And now it's getting to be true faster today than it's ever been true in the past. So the speed of change is certainly increasing. But just the idea that there are new types of jobs being created and other ones being destroyed is something that's really always been with us.
Let's dive into Vicarious more specifically. You note that the organization is building a unified algorithmic architecture to achieve human-level intelligence in vision, language, and motor control, which is a more specific way of describing what you mentioned a moment ago in terms of the definition of artificial intelligence and how it applies at your organization. You've gone on to say that you're focused on visual perception problems like recognition, segmentation, scene parsing. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about where things stand now, nearly 5.5 years into this journey, and your strategy for the foreseeable future.
You could think about it as the way AI is commonly used as creating a mapping between inputs and outputs. So you have lots and lots of technologies out there, particularly neural networks, where you train a system with lots of labeled data that says these are the good examples, these are the bad examples, or these are the cats and these are the dogs, or whatever you want to classify or make decisions based on. And you feed that system a ton of data on a big cluster of computers, and then you create a little black box that, given some inputs, gives you some prediction of output. And that is the existing world of state-of-the-art machine learning. It's what powered Google's Go playing computer. It's what helps self-driving cars to identify pedestrians. It's the mainstay of AI research. I think that's great technology, but it's also pretty different from what we're building at Vicarious. We're building something that's referred to in the field as generative models. So we're not just interested in drawing a boundary between what are the good things or the bad things, or what are the cat or the dogs or the cars and the pedestrians. We're interested in knowing what actually makes a car. Could something with two wheels also be counted as a car or as a vehicle? And how do things tend to move in the world? And what kind of cause and effect relationships can you learn? Much in the same way that a human is able to learn these more complex relationships. And the reason why that's important is that the existing systems are limited to drawing boundaries between lots of examples that it's seen in the past. And this is the Achilles heel of things like the Google self-driving car, where when it's in a new scenario, and there are new scenarios every day when you're driving, it's hard for it to generalize to those new scenarios because it's just trying to put the new scenarios in the context of its database of prior experiences. So without something that's like the kind of generative model we're building at Vicarious, it's hard to solve those problems. So that's the frontier of artificial intelligence research that we're pushing on.
And how do you map that out? You mentioned earlier that you're hoping to develop the power through your definition of artificial intelligence to recreate the human-like learning experience from birth to adulthood. How do you map out those stages? How do you choose areas to focus on or not focus on?
Thankfully, there's tons of research on how the brain develops and the phases that infants go through in evolving their model of the world. So we can leverage 50, 60 years of past literature in neuroscience and in cognitive science and in behavior. And so that's been really helpful for us. And it's actually kind of interesting. If you look at the techniques, the mainstay techniques that are powering even the Go player, they do draw their inspiration from a bunch of neuroscience that was done back in the 70s. You can kind of think about Vicarious as arbitrage between what we've learned about human development and about the brain in the last 30 years and what exists in mainstream AI.
You've talked about how your company isn't focused on launching products per se in the short term, and that anything you do ship will be kind of a side effect of the research being done. Additionally, you're a flexible purpose corporation and you're choosing to pursue the maximization of social benefit as opposed to profit. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the rationale behind that and the sort of longer term focus, obviously, that provides.
Well, I guess the real macro of it is that I think we've, as a society, created a system that optimizes shareholder wealth when really we want a system that optimizes happiness or optimizes social good or a productive society or something like that. It's not exactly the same thing as shareholder wealth. And because there is this difference between what we optimize and what we want, we get things like Enron or things like people dumping horribly toxic chemicals into water supplies, because those are the kinds of actions that maximize shareholder wealth on some timescale, but they aren't really good for society. So I like the movement towards these alternative entities like Social Purpose Corporation or the B Corporation, because it calls into view and into alignment and into integrity the role of the corporation and the role of having a productive market economy in creating the kind of society that all of us would want to live in. And so the choice to make Vicarious a flexible purpose corporation or a social purpose corporation is an obvious one, simply because I think every corporation should really be serving that purpose. By making product, you make the world into a more enjoyable and robust place where people have more leisure time and can live longer, healthier lives. So that's the philosophical angle. And then when we look at, in particular, what is it that we're building? We're building a new technology that has very significant implications in the future of society and many different social systems that exist today. And so especially because we're building something that's very powerful and can be used in a lot of ways that are both good and bad, or either good or bad, I think it's important that we ethically ground our efforts to do so in a legal framework that captures the guiding moral principles of our work.
And you've built a team of 30 people, and I'm curious, what has the recruiting process, bringing people in with this longer-term perspective, the desire to do well by doing good, but also, frankly, running contrary, at least to stereotypes, which obviously have their limitations, but stereotypes nevertheless, of Silicon Valley as a place where people run to strive to achieve the next big financial event within the company that they're a part of. I'm curious, as you now have sort of seen what motivates people to join your company and obviously have a means of attracting great talent, what sort of perspective has it given you?
The biggest perspective I've gained is that it's neither of the things you mentioned. I'd say there's some amount of motivation towards the ethical value of creating a better world for all of humanity. There's some amount of motivation towards having personal reward. But I think the thing that motivates most people who work on this problem is the fascinatingness and the weight and the intricacy of the problem itself. Understanding what it is that makes us tick as humans and what computation really is happening inside our conscious mind. And then writing a program that demonstrates that you really do understand it, having that program come to life, is a captivating problem. And it's the kind of thing that brilliant people can't help but think about. And so being able to work on that problem with the 29 other most brilliant people in the field on that problem, I think is its own reward. And it's something that I certainly feel thrilled to get out of bed every day and come to work and be around everyone who's striving forward to push the frontier of what's possible in this area.
Obviously, this is a very hot segment of technology right now. And it's interesting. I'd be curious, given all you've just said about the way in which you even think about competition within this space versus, say, coopetition or even just full-on cooperation with various organizations that might be somewhat like your own or have charters comparable to yours. On the flip side, I would also ask you, what makes Vicarious different relative to other players that are approaching things from a similar point of view?
To take the big view on competition versus cooperation, I'd say society as a whole is underinvesting on artificial general intelligence because it's the most important technology I think that we'll ever build because it's also the last. If you can build something that can think fully like a human, then it can do all the things that we humans do today, but significantly faster and better and cheaper. And so as an area, I feel great anytime I hear that more thought and more resources are being put into how do we create a positive singularity and how we build the first intelligent computers. That's something that's really exciting to me, and that's what I'm here to do. And it's not us versus them or a one person wins at all scenario. It's the kind of thing where I think as a society, we need to prioritize this work. And I'm really glad to see resources being applied to it. And then the other thing about how is Vicarious unique or where we fit into the competitive landscape, a lot of work is being done on improving the kind of existing neural network architectures that have been in vogue for the last 4 years or so. And I think that work is fantastic and needs to continue. But rather than talking about the AI frontier, I think we should talk about the AI frontier as a and there are many different ways of framing the problem, how are humans intelligent? And I'd like to see pressure put on all of them. And Vicarious's particular approach, which is drawing inductive biases from neuroscience and cognitive science and framing them into a grounded mathematical framework and then testing it on data sets that demonstrate its superiority, is something that I don't see a lot of other companies doing. I see many people in the for-profit startup area doing vertical applications of what we're going to take deep learning and we're going to apply it to medical imaging, and then we're going to produce a better diagnosis for patients and charge the money to do that, which really isn't fundamental research into what makes humans think, the application of a technology to a vertical. And then on the nonprofit research side, I see a couple of companies like OpenAI, like Allen Institute for Artificial Intelligence, and like a bunch of the big research labs who are trying out some different techniques and trying to push on the frontiers. And those, I think, are pretty exciting. And then Vicarious among them, and our particular take on what's the right strategy to build human-level and human-like AI is unique from a technology standpoint and probably also from an organizational standpoint.
one of the ways in which you do compete is for talent. And you mentioned a moment ago, you've got 29 of the brightest minds in this space. I wonder how you've thought about staffing the organization. What sorts of skills are you particularly looking for? How have you thought about building out your organization as it has grown? And then likewise, how have you thought about partnerships with other organizations? You talked about, of course, the research that you're leveraging from universities or other organizations that is relevant to this. Curious about how you thought about that ecosystem that you're building.
For us, competition hasn't been a significant problem so far. And we've had 1,100 people apply for those 30 spots. So most of the work has been on sorting out like who are really the best people for us to work with. And then the other thing I think that's different about Vicarious is that because our strategy for solving these problems is unique amongst the landscape of other companies, people who want to do the kind of research that we're doing want to do it here. And people who want to do the kind of research that some other group is doing, Allen Institute for AI is doing, they go and do it there. And so it's not really a cutthroat recruiting rate as you might expect. And then in terms of how do we have 1,100 people apply for 30 positions, I think the people who really care deeply about solving this problem are on the lookout for where are the other ones who are also working on the frontiers of what's possible and what groups have the resources to commit to pursuing that in a very long-term way. And I think we're probably the only startup that is asking those questions and has the runway and the supporters and the investors and so on to really pursue the big vision here.
In October of 2013, your organization passed the Turing test, so to speak, by breaking CAPTCHA, the system intended to distinguish human versus machine input for websites, often used for login or checkout on sites. Since then, there have been a number of prominent organizations that have had this sort of defeating technology or defeating humans, like IBM Watson beating the Jeopardy champions, or more recently, Google's DeepMind's AlphaGo defeating the world's best Go players last week. And I'm curious, actually, what role do you feel like these great events that rightfully earn publicity, what role does it play in focusing the general public and investors on the opportunities here? And are we at the point now where it's enough of a given that more can be happening behind the scenes without necessarily the need for this bigger representation? How do you think about that sort of complementary basis of those?
I don't think it's necessarily bad to have world fair style demonstrations of a new technology that we're proud of and we're excited about. It's always exciting to see a computer do something that it wasn't able to do before, whether it's play Go really well or Jeopardy or break CAPTCHAs. So I think that kind of stuff's cool. I think there is a problem in the media of misunderstanding what the technology actually is and what it's doing, what it's capable of, and what it means. So every time one of these events occurs, and Vicarious, as much a victim of this as DeepMind has been, where you publish a thing that you're like, okay, we can solve all these CAPTCHAs and pass this Turing test, or we can win a Go. And then the press turns it into an achievement or an event of grand proportions that sort of far exceeds its technological relevance or what you intended it to present it as. So I think there can be a downside to these sort of world fair events, which is when people don't understand what's going on behind the scenes or don't think clearly about what the event really means, they can turn it into, oh, we're imminently about to have X, Y, or Z, or these problems are bigger than they are. So I think that's a risk of it. But I think if we can have careful journalism and not get too ahead of ourselves here, then it's always fun to see a computer do something new.
You've attracted an extraordinary group of investors with the likes of Elon Musk and Mark Zuckerberg, Vinod Khosla, Peter Thiel, Jeff Bezos, among others. First of all, I'm curious how you have done so. And likewise, I'd be interested in how you interact with your investors on a regular basis, what impact they're having on the direction and the strategy of the organization.
All of our investors at Vicarious understand the fundamental role of artificial intelligence in transforming society and transforming their businesses. So whether you're Jeff Bezos and you want to have robotic drone deliveries of products or robotic arms that put things in boxes, or you're Elon Musk and you want to have Teslas that can drive themselves, or you're Mark Zuckerberg and you're working on all kinds of AI initiatives related to being a personal assistant, all of these rely on fundamental advances in AI technology. And investing in Vicarious is a way for each of those leaders to help push the frontier further and faster. And there's going to be very tangible and obvious downstream benefits to each of their organizations. Kind of like they do have their own in-house teams, but those teams are focused on things that are less pure research and more directly applicable to the product lines that exist today or will exist in the near future of each of those companies. So kind of like how there's a new type of optical processor or quantum computer or something coming out. That might be a product that each of those companies would purchase to improve their infrastructure and to help them achieve their goals better. But they don't necessarily need to develop it all by themselves in-house. They can buy it from Intel or from some newcomer who develops it. So it's just a question of to what extent is pushing the frontier of brain-like AI important to that company or that CEO as a priority versus is it something that they can support through an investment and can develop outside of that organization?
You mentioned earlier, Scott, that when you're talking about expanding artificial intelligence in the ways that you described, it's important to have a note of caution. And there's been a lot written about the reward versus the risk of artificial intelligence. In fact, there are investors in your organization, Elon Musk being among those, who've weighed in about some of the concerns about the risks. I wonder what your perspectives are on that in terms of the balance between the reward versus the risk of AI.
I think the balance is very firmly on the reward side. That said, every new technology that's created since the invention of fire can be used for keeping warm or for burning a lot of stuff. So I think an essential part of developing a new technology is making sure that it's safe and effective and used in the ways that you want it to be used and for humanity's benefit. AI is no different in that way. It's probably different in scale on both the positive and negative side. So it's something that we take seriously and all of the researchers who are working on it take seriously. I also think it's very early. It's the kind of thing that, like, we have researchers who are studying genetically engineered superviruses and nanotechnology and asteroid impact. We should have researchers who are studying AI safety and how to make sure that we have human-aligned artificial intelligences and so on. But it should be a relatively academic field, just like asteroid collisions is an academic field.
So it's not the sort of thing that dominates your conversations on a day-in, day-out basis, but something that you're sort of bearing in mind as you proceed.
Yeah, it's something that everyone who is in this field and seriously working on it is aware of the different corresponding safety issues that are part of building this technology. And it's something that we take seriously and we keep in view as we develop the AI that we're building.
We talked a little bit about the extent to which this will take over processes that humans have traditionally done, and you made the very valid point that that's been sort of the story of the advancements of technology for many decades now. There seems like there are a great number of jobs that are likely to be replaced potentially in the relatively near term. You talked about, for instance, as personal assistants might replace actual assistants, for instance. I wonder what your perspectives are in terms of how we as a society ought to be thinking about those people whose jobs are likely to be replaced by artificial intelligence and machine learning.
I'm a big fan of work programs and guaranteed basic income. I think that government and society has a role to play in ensuring a smooth transition between technological disruption. And I think that we can have a society where there's tons of jobs for everyone, that there's always going to be stuff to do. And it's a matter of making sure that when someone was doing one thing and they were used to doing that thing, there are an easeful transition into being able to do something new.
I noticed that one of your concentrations as an undergrad at the University of Pennsylvania was entrepreneurship. And obviously, you've taken the theoretical that you learned there and transitioned that quite successfully to the practical of having started multiple organizations, including the one we're talking about today, Vicarious. But I'm curious, actually, if you've got perspectives on how valuable the classroom aspects of entrepreneurship are.
Frankly, I would say not valuable at all. You have to learn by doing. I was relatively naive when I was 17 years old. I decided to go to Penn because it was the only Ivy with a business school and a computer science program for undergrads. And when I got there, I discovered that the business school was primarily for training investment bankers and management consultants. Maybe this has changed since then, but when I was there anyway, there was, I think, two courses on engineering entrepreneurship. It wasn't a vibrant ecosystem, and it wasn't a place really where I would characterize it as, oh, this is a great education in how to run a startup. What was a great education in how to run a startup was going through the Y Combinator program back in 2008 and learning from the partners at YC and from my classmates the right practices for building a company. And I think that's only gotten better. I think college has a place and is wonderful, but if you want to learn about entrepreneurship, the only way to do that is by actually getting out there and doing it, and doing it in the presence of great mentors, advisors, and investors.
To close, I'd love to get your thoughts on where you see Vicarious in the foreseeable future. Maybe you could even help with sort of the time frame that you think about. You know, as you think, say, 3-5 years down the road, what are some of your hopes for where the organization will be and some of the areas in which you will have innovated?
So there's this great quote I love about business plans. It's the best business plans are the ones that never change. In our case, we're 5 years in, and I'm fortunate to say that we've always had the same plan, which is build the first human-level AI and do it by gathering insights from neuroscience, from mathematics, from the inductive biases required to create something that learns and thinks like a human and apply them in a rigorous scientific way to creating fundamental advancements. And the exhaust of that process are things that are commercially useful. So in the last 12 months, we've taken on investment from Samsung, Samsung, from ABB, Power and Automation, and from Wipro, and we're also about to announce some additional corporate investors who all see the role of AI in their futures and see how vicarious technology can help them succeed. So I think that the world that we're headed towards is a world where vicarious can be an Intel inside for artificial intelligence inside of a lot of products and a lot of different areas that we come to rely on in our day-to-day lives.
Do you think of the B2B versus B2C implications, the enterprise versus individual implications, as different or part of the same thing?
In our case, I see them as part of the same thing. We're fundamentally a scientific research and algorithms company. We're about creating enabling technologies for building this AI revolution, shovels in the gold rush, if you will. And so from our perspective, there isn't that much of a difference between the technology we provide for a consumer product or for a B2B product. Our core competency here is not designing pretty user interfaces and figuring out how to optimize the virality coefficient of an iPhone app. Our core competency is building the best possible AI software and using it to help humanity thrive. And so that's what you'll see from us as part of it. And it doesn't really require a shift in lenses to go between the consumer and the industrial settings.
Excellent. Well, Scott Phoenix, thank you so much for joining us on the Forum on World Class IT. It's been a great conversation.
Yeah, thanks for having me today.
You've just listened to a podcast in a series we call Meta Strategies Forum on World Class IT. If you like what you've heard, please consider reading my book, World Class IT, Why Businesses Succeed When IT Triumphs, published by Josie Bass, a division of Wiley Press, in December of 2009. Both the book and the Forum on World Class IT offer stories from a wide range of top IT leaders relating to Meta Strategies' five principles of World Class IT. The five principles are as follows. Principle one is people, and it's really the foundational principle. Without the right people doing the right jobs at the right time, it'll be nearly impossible to achieve excellent performance. The second principle is infrastructure. We like to say that this is the principle that separates proactive organizations from reactive ones. If infrastructure is not reliably performing its tasks, the IT organization will become stuck in reactive mode, consistently fighting fires. If systems and hardware and networks and so on work reliably, then a larger portion of the organization can think about the future. The third principle is project and portfolio management. This is the engine through which new capabilities can be brought to bear on behalf of the company. It is important to ensure that projects are delivered on time, on budget, and on target, and that the portfolio collectively supports the objectives of the business. The fourth principle is IT and business partnerships. It's important that, first and foremost, the different parts of IT, from business analysis to development and QA, through to support and all other aspects of IT, communicate effectively and efficiently. It's equally important, then, that IT develop a partnering relationship with the business that it is a part of. If the three prior principles are done well, then IT should earn a place at the strategy setting table, driving different parts of the business strategy. The fifth and last principle is external partnerships. Outsourcing is becoming a crucial weapon that organizations are employing, and managing these relationships to ensure that value is achieved is critical. In the fourth principle, the organization has learned and contributed to the discussion about what is strategic and what is not. Once that's clear, then it will be easier to determine which aspects of IT might be better managed by external partners or vendors. For more information on these five principles and the sub-principles that are associated with each, please visit our website at www.metastrategy.com, and please share your thoughts and comments by contacting us at feedback@metastrategy.com. And our theme music was written by David Armin. I'm Peter High. Thanks for listening.